The question that's being asked is, it is true that God commanded us to do certain commandments. What would be wrong, what would be the problem for a person if he did not obey God? What would be what is wrong with not obeying God? That was the question. Answer. They would say, well, how is it possible not to obey God, the creator of the universe who created you? How could you not obey him? Both the question, the person that asked the question, both the person that answers it in that way, are really both working with the same premise. They're working with the premise that God is an authority. And therefore, the question is, should I listen to authority or should I disobey authority? That's the usual way that we relate to authorities. And I think that's an incorrect relationship to God. This is that God set up the world, that he is the authority, and he is telling us what to do. Now, I say that statement is a misunderstanding of God's relationship to the physical world and God's relationship to giving the Torah to the world. Okay? I say it's a misunderstanding. Start with a very, very simple question. Why does a person look two ways when he crosses the street? Is it because his parents told him he shouldn't? Or is it because he knows the consequences of his actions? Now, definitely it is because, I mean, a child might do it if he doesn't understand. He might do it because of authority and obey his parents because he doesn't want to lose his parents or be punished by his parents. But however, when you get older, then you realize that you should do it because you shouldn't get killed. And all the other things that your person has to do, which makes sense, they do it because it is reality. And if you do not live in reality, then you will pay the consequences for not living in reality. Okay? Now, when God created the world, right? So therefore, he created all the laws of nature, right? Okay. Now, when you keep the laws of nature, do you keep it because God said so? Or because you know that if you violate the laws of nature, you'll pay the consequences? Definitely most people, I mean, the person keeps the laws of nature, of course he'll pay the consequences, okay? Now, and we know, we only know God, we don't know God himself, so we only know God that really, that he is the source of all reality or all nature in this world, right? So whatever God does, that is the laws of nature. That is reality, right? So therefore, when God gave a Torah, that Torah is a reality by virtue that God gave it. Not as an authority, but it is reality because whatever God does, he's the source of reality. And just like if you violate the laws of the physical laws of nature, as you know it, you pay the consequences. So too, if you violate the laws of the Torah, you are it is not that God comes down specially, but the thing is that there are consequences which was given in Torah, where God said that if you do these things wrong, these consequences will happen. And it's inherent within nature. It's not the cause of nature that we know. But it's a divine providence. By divine providence, we mean that there is a system, a secondary system after the laws of nature, secondary system that works based on your relationship to Torah. And that is a system. But because you don't see it as a system, you relate back to God, that the God is a being an authority and telling me what to do. But that is, when God tells you what to do, that is reality. That makes it the laws of nature. is why didn't God say, thou shalt look both ways before you cross the street? Okay? The reason is because that which you could perceive with your five senses, that and every normal human being recognizes the consequences. When it starts getting more abstract, you see, where the consequences are abstract, that the regular everyday person doesn't see it. Even in practicality, I mean, the Torah helps us out with ethics and morals, where you could see the consequences. I mean, if you study them, you see that there is a deep, that morality is not because that's unmoral, like it's a feeling that it's immoral, it's a feeling that it's unethical. But you see, if you don't live a rational life in morals and ethics will bring about certain consequences. You'll suffer certain consequences if you don't live correctly. So even that the Torah has to help us out with, because it's very abstract and a lot of people will miss that point. Okay? Now, the thing is, it's true that God gave the Torah that it's a command. And we on our own would never know what the Torah is, you see. We can never write a Torah. You can never discover. In other words, in morals and ethics, a human being can discover a lot of the ideas that you have in Torah. You could find it because it's there. But nobody would discover halacha. You might find that you need laws for criminal, for criminal things. Everybody knows it's that you know have to have a society, you have to have laws. But however, nobody would think of Shabbos and kosher and these type of things, okay? But the thing is, it's true that God told you the facts. But however, by virtue of God telling you the facts, that makes it a reality. That is the reality, because whatever God does, He's the source of reality. See, when we start out, the person starts out with God the authority, and I have to obey God, because I'm a religious person. How can I not obey God? Like we said, how is it possible not to obey God? The answer is that's when we start out. But however, once you recognize that God is a source of reality, then by virtue that He says it, it's not that I'm doing it because God commanded me, but I'm doing it for the same reason why I look two ways when I cross the street. But the only thing is, it's more abstract. It comes via the idea of God. The question is, what's the difference between consequence and punishment? In other words, like, for instance, when you don't look both ways, so you get a consequence. If you smoke, you get a consequence, and we know the consequence. But however, we look at when God says, if you don't keep the Torah, you will be punished, it doesn't seem to be it seems to be a punishment, not a consequence. Okay? That's the question. So the thing is that when, you see, the thing is the reason there's a different term, because consequences we could see within the laws of nature, you see. But however, the knowledge of the consequences of not keeping the Torah, that system, what's going to happen to us, we can only see via the Torah. Or sometimes you could see in general, after the Torah tells you how it works, so then you could, if you look over the history of the Jewish nation, you'll see that certain things happen, so you could tell, in general, that the system, what God said in the Torah, works, you see? But you see it as a system. It's not a particular, like a parent, if you do this, I'm going to punish you. I'm going to hit you. It's not an outside thing. It is also part of the system. You see, it's also part of the system that these punishments must occur. And just like there's certain consequences that don't happen right away in the physical world, so sometimes there are consequences which happen right away. Sometimes there are consequences which take a long time. You see? But the consequence must be there. But it is a consequence. Insofar as the soul is concerned, every time you do an action, it affects your very soul. It affects your personality. It affects you, whether good or bad. whatever decision you make, that affects you right away. But the physical consequences that come out the later, most of them seem to come later. The consequences seem to be down the pike a certain amount of time or sequence of events. Many times it's not immediate. Whether there are immediate punishments, we'll have to look through Torah to see how it works and what situations it would occur. The question that we're asking here is let's say, for instance, God said, you're not permitted to light a fire on Shabbos, okay? Now, the question is, how is that a reality? That's just a command. It's just a command. How is that a reality, okay? The question is when a child crosses the street, it doesn't real... And let's say the child knows that it's not looking both ways. It's a fact. I'm not looking both ways. It doesn't understand how looking both ways has anything to do with their life when crossing the street. When they become an adult, then they recognize looking both ways is really looking for a car because there's something out there that can harm them, and therefore looking both ways is connected with another fact which causes harm. Is that correct? Now, when you look at the commandments of the Torah, you really, when you ask that question, you're looking at the commandments of the Torah as the child looks at looking both ways. They don't understand the idea of a car hurting them. And so therefore you only look at the commandments, you see, as a separate entity. But however, when God gave the blessing that if you keep the Torah, right, if you keep the whole Torah, then you'll get blessings, and if you don't keep the Torah, then you'll get all the curses that God said when on the mountains, where he said all the curses that will get all the problems that will occur to us, right? So the thing is that God set this Torah, and he made it part of a system that in other words, just like, see, there's two separate acts. There's looking and not looking both ways, and a car coming and hitting you. In other words, now when you look two ways, you're protecting yourself against the car. But a child that doesn't understand how a car could hurt you, so the child could walk across without looking two ways. Is that correct? Is that correct? Yes? Okay. Now the same thing, see, when we look at Torah, we don't see the system of Torah connected. We don't see the system of Torah connected with the system that God placed in the world that if you keep the Torah, you will get the blessings. If you don't keep the Torah, you'll get the punishments. You see? So therefore, it is connected. The system, the halachic system, is connected to the to a system. It's not. In other words, when we look at it, we look at it in a thing in and of itself. Like, well, okay, I keep the halacha, or I don't keep the halacha. What does that have to do with reality? The answer is that God related that exactly how. I can't tell you. With the crossing the street, that I can explain very clearly. Over here, all I know is the Torah told us that it is connected to a system. And the system works something like this. If you keep the Torah, so then you'll have all the blessings. If you don't keep the Torah, then you won't have these blessings. So therefore, that's why you do have the consequences, and therefore it is a part of a system that God created. The question is, isn't the real harm of not keeping Torah that you're destroying your own self? How you destroy yourself, your soul, or whatever, how you destroy yourself, that's a separate question. But the thing is that the truth is there are many different consequences. In other words, there is a consequence if you don't keep Torah that you're destroying yourself, and there is the physical consequences that you will get if you do not keep Torah. Both of them are consequences. God calls to Abraham. He says, Abraham. Now the question is that a reality? Okay?
Okay.
That's the question. A person makes a half a statement. He only says half the statement, right? Does a half a statement make any sense? And it only makes sense only after he finishes the statement. Is that correct? Okay. Now, when he says Abraham, is that all he wants to say is Abraham? He likes the word Abraham? He likes the way it sounds? Or he's just the beginning of a statement, and since he's dealing with humans, he has to catch your attention. So he calls your name. Then he makes the statement. Now, that statement, whatever he says to you, is reality. When God tells Abraham that your children are going to go down to Egypt, or God tells Jacob you should go back to the land of Canaan, that he is telling him that that is your reality now. That is what you must do. If you don't, you will pay the consequences. So therefore, I'm telling you what your reality is. In other words, when God commands you to do something, it is equal to your parents commanding you not to go in the street. Why? Because when they're commanding you, you look at them as an authority, but they're just telling you, don't get the consequences. Because if you go in the street, you will get hurt, but you don't understand it yet, so they can't tell you. Now, the same thing, when you start off with God the authority. You can't help it. But then as you see how the divine providence works, you see, how it works, so then you start seeing the connection between halacha and the divine providence, so then you'll see that, yeah, how could you not keep it? Of course, you see the consequences. In other words, we said there are really three levels. The first level is the person that looks at God as the authority. That's like a child looks at his parents, and his parents tell him the correct things, but they're only telling him the results. He can't understand that it's a reality. The second level is where you see the consequences, so you see the reality via the consequences. There is another level where even where the consequences are not, I just relate to reality itself. In other words, it's a person that his nature is, he reaches a certain level where his nature is to relate to reality itself. And therefore, that is the person that simply wants to do the will of God, not because he's worried about this or that consequence that God will give him if he doesn't obey, or this reward if he does obey. But his nature is that he has to relate to reality itself. So therefore, that is the highest level that a person relates to reality. Why does a person on the third level look two ways when he crosses? The answer is that he knows to avoid consequences. He's not foolish. There are certain acts that the purpose of the act is to avoid a consequence. Like, for instance, looking two ways, that's the purpose of the act. But the purpose of keeping Shabbos, its purpose is not to avoid a consequence. Maybe a person on a lower level will relate to it that way. But the person on the higher level, when he relates to Shabbos and the ideas of Shabbos and the understanding of the areas of Torah, he relates to it not because of a consequence or reward. He relates to it because he wants to relate to reality, and through that relating to the ultimate reality, namely God. And looks two ways, the very nature of looking two ways is to avoid, that's the purpose. The very purpose of looking two ways is to avoid a consequence. Now, if the whole act, its purpose is to avoid a consequence, then on any level you must look two ways to avoid a consequence. That must be your purpose. You realize there to avoid a consequence. But however, there's certain actions which you could relate to, not because it's to avoid a consequence. Its nature is not that way. If you don't do it, you will have a consequence, but its nature is not to avoid a consequence. The nature is to relate to God. And therefore, when you keep Torah, its relationship is just simply to relate to the source of all reality, because you're a person that live in line with reality. So therefore, you want to relate to the source of all reality. Okay? If you don't see the Torah as reality, then it's true. You must relate to God as an authority. You have no choice. That's the only thing you have. But as you understand the ideas and you start seeing the whole system of Torah, the system of halacha and the system of God's divine providence, so then as you start seeing the system, then you start relating to God as the source of reality. You must have knowledge to be able to relate to God that way. You must have knowledge of a system to be able to relate to God as the source of that system. The question is, what if a person does, in other words, let's say there were no consequences in Torah, right? Now the question is, would the person on the second level keep Torah? The answer is, if you're on the second level where the only thing that keeps you connected to Torah is your reward and punishment, that part of reality, so you would have no motive. Psychologically, there would be nothing keeping you. There would be no person that could reach the third level. But you must go through the level of reward and punishment, right? You must go through that stage of reward and punishment, and then you attach to reality by virtue of reward and punishment. Then there's another level where I relate to truth itself. Now the thing is, let's say for instance when a person looks two ways, right? Now the person on the third level also sees that as a punishment. Because the whole nature of looking two ways is to avoid a con- that's its nature. You see, that's the nature of looking two ways. Now if in Torah there was no punishment, or there was no reward, there's no reward or punishment, then why should I keep it? Then I don't have any punishment, and I don't have any reward, so a person on the second level would never have any reason for keeping it. He would never have a chance to reach the third level where he relates to it via reality. And the question is, if a person, what's the difference between a person that keeps the Torah because of authority? Because definitely if he keeps it because of authority, definitely he's afraid of reward and punishment. And the next level where he worries about the consequences of his actions and God is the source of all reality, the question is, it seems to be that the two levels, insofar as motivation is concerned, it seems to be that there's no difference. It seems to be exactly the same. This is, again, the first person that keeps Torah is that he looks at Torah the same way that a child looks at a parent. There's no reason why I should do this act. There is no benefit or harm or any, there's no reality attached to this reason. I only obey the authority. And if I don't obey the authority will punish me. If I do obey the authority will reward me. That's the first level. The second level is I see God as the source of all reality. I see a system, but I still need crime and punishment or reward and punishment to be able to keep me going, to keep the mitzvahs. But I see it now as a consequence of not living the right way or a result of living the correct way. I see the benefits clearly. I see the relationship. But I haven't reached a level where I could let drop the reward and punishment. So the thing is, I've reached a different level in that I see that there is, like for instance, I'll give you a little different illustration in ethics. Let's say for instance, when you first start out, You know, you read Torah, you know that Torah holds that jealousy is wrong. Right? So you try to deal with jealousy based on an authority. But then let's say, for instance, you see the... let's take a gossip, right? That you know how to gossip, right? So a lot of people control themselves from gossiping because it's wrong. You shouldn't hurt other people, right? But let's say we show you that gossip will hurt you. That there are consequences in your personal life for gossiping, you see? So therefore, that's a different view of gossiping than the first view of gossiping. In other words, there are two people that control themselves from gossiping. One sees it that God said, don't hurt other people. So it's not nice to hurt other people. God doesn't want me to hurt other people. Or I could look at gossiping not in terms of hurting other people, but in terms of that type of life. What are the consequences of living a life of a gossiper? You see? That's what I'm talking about. Then there's a certain love of the truth. There's simply a love of the truth where it has nothing to do with the consequences. In other words, in all three levels, you're doing the correct act. If you obey God because of authority or the consequences or because you relate to reality, the act that you're doing is correct. That is objective. What the correct act is the Torah. That's objective. Okay? But however, how you relate to it, your emotions, subjectively, there are three ways of relating to that objective truth. One is as an authority, one is as afraid of the consequences, and three, I just want to relate the truth itself. Okay, the question is, we hold that everything has to be worked out according to the consequence. In other words, everything you do in life has to be made with a plan thought out, and you have to work it out yourself, right? Now, if you work everything out yourself, so the question is, wherein lies trust in God? That's the question. Wherein lies trust of God? Some people have trust in God much earlier, right? But however, according to Mishlei, where everything has to be worked out, and that's Proverbs. According to Proverbs, everything has to be worked out rationally, and if you see in the Torah, there is a certain formula that you have to operate on. One case is where Jacob is going to meet Esau, and he sends presents as a peace treaty. Then he divides the camp. He prepares for war, and then he prays to God to ask God to make sure that one of those two ways works. So you see that the first step is total planning, and then you turn to God. Now the question is, where does trust in God come in? Okay, in Esther, in the book of Esther, chapter 4, in the middle of verse 14, it says that Mordechai says to Esther, he says, "And who knows whether you have not for a time like this attain to the royal dignity." Okay? So he uses the term "who knows." In other words, which seems to point to the idea that there's a certain probability that you were put in this situation. But Mordechai, who knows all the knowledge, right, who knows all this knowledge of God, still is not 100% sure. It's only a high probability. Now, based on this high probability, Esther has to make a decision. You see? That's where betachon, that's where trust in God comes in. You see, trust in God comes in as a result of your knowledge. Trust of God doesn't come in that I'm going to do anything. You see? It's where it's still based on knowledge. It's still based on truth. But it's not 100% clear. You still have to trust in God at a certain point. The same thing with Yaakov. Jacob went to Canaan. He went back to Canaan. He knew he had to face his brother. You see, and he wasn't 100% sure if he'll make it. But still, in all, he went there, and that is where trust in God comes. The question is that when you read through the Psalms, you see that King David seems to have a tremendous amount of trust in God, that God is going to protect him at all times. Okay? See that he had more trust than what I'm saying here. I'm saying that that you have to trust, in other words, in God's system, whether it will work or not, whether God will actually help you. King David seemed to have more trust in that and seemed to think that God will always help him, right? So the thing is, the trust seemed to be 100% in that God will save him. In Samuel 2, verse 25, it says, "And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back again and show me both it and his dwelling." It meaning the ark, and the dwelling means the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. "But if he should thus say, I have no delight in thee," meaning in David, "I have no delight in David, here am I," David says, "let him do to me as seems good in his eyes." Okay? In other words, David says, "I'm leaving the city now, I'm running away, right? I have no choice." He says, "Now, but if it is part of God's plan that I should have to run away and he should bring me back, then I'll be very happy. But if not, then I accept God's decree, whatever it may be." So you see that he is not 100% secure that God is going to carry out his everything good for David. So the question is, so what is he saying about in the Psalms, what you mentioned, that he always seems so secure that God is going to help him? Right? What is the difference between the David that's speaking in Samuel and the David that's speaking in Psalms, which seems to be nothing will go wrong? Right? Well, what's the difference? The answer is like this. That when a person starts out relating, when a person comes into this world, there's a terrible, terrible insecurity in the physical world. And because of that insecurity, I mean, anything could happen. I mean, people could harm you, the physical world, Mount St. Helens could blow, you know, anything could happen. I mean, that's beyond your control. So the thing is, there's terrible, terrible insecurities. As a result of this insecurity, people turn to God. Okay? Now, in Torah, we hold that we should study God's truth, God's reality. Okay? And via the Torah. Okay? So the thing is, as we start studying truth and reality through the eyes of the Torah, we learn to accept reality for what it is. Okay? And when we accept this reality, there's a point where we're able to accept our own death. Okay? Now, if we're able to accept our own death, so then wherein lies our relationship to God? There has to be a change. Because before we needed God because of our insecurities. Right? Now the question, if I could accept my death, that I accept reality that, you know, that I live and I die and that's it. So then wherein lies my relationship to God? King David is not... The question is that maybe when the catastrophe is happening, maybe King David is insecure. The answer is, you see that here the worst catastrophe is happening and he's not insecure. He is accepting reality for whatever it is. His reality is that God can protect him, that God will bring him back, or it could be that God will not accept him, which means he'll never come back. That's it, he's finished. You see? He accepts that reality, that truth, whatever God's will is. You see? That's where he's at. The question is, so what's my relationship to God? At this point, what's my relationship to God? Is that a person on a certain level simply wants to relate to God. That's all. In other words, as you study reality, there's a certain desire to relate to the cause of all reality. You see? The cause of all reality is namely God. Now, your relationship to him has changed. Your relationship started out, what can God do for me? You see? Now my relationship is, how could I fit in to God's reality? I must accept all of God's reality. That is reality. I want to live in reality. Every human being strives to live in reality to the best that they can. But the only thing is that once you realize that God is the source of all reality, then you want to live according to his reality. So therefore, the thing is, in other words, when you start out, is I'm going to relate to God so God can protect me. Once you accept reality, you don't need God's protection. You accept death. You see? What you're doing is not what God could do for me, but how can I relate to God? And I could relate to God by accepting whatever God does to me, whatever it may be, then I could accept. You could also see that maybe a little bit clearer. There's a medrash which says that Avraham went against the king, who was the god, who was considered the god at the time, you know, and they made a big fire and they were going to kill him. Meanwhile, Avraham's brother was standing there, and it was a question whether he should accept the God of Abraham. So he said, "I'll see. You know, if Abraham makes it, right? So then I'll accept. If Abraham doesn't make it, so I won't accept." Now, Abraham was thrown into the fire, and he walked out. Now, Nachar, his brother, was thrown into the fire, according to the Medrash, and he died. Now, what was the difference? The difference is that Abraham didn't know if he would make it out. He didn't know if God would save him, but he accepted God's decree. He knew that his responsibility is not to give in to idol worship, and therefore whatever happens, he has to go. Now, if he dies, fine. If he doesn't, he doesn't. But he has to accept God's decree. He must live in line with God's reality. Nachar was simply a practical person. He was relating to God for practical reasons. If he saves him, so he'll save me. If he'll save me, I'll accept him. God will save me, I'll accept him. If not, not. That's not the level that God will relate to you. But that is the level that people have to start off with. They must start off with that level. Then later, it's just an acceptance of God's reality. Prayer, when you pray and ask God for something, so then you are asking God for something to be given to you, right? So therefore, to change, right, so to speak, to change his decree. Because in other words, right now, something bad is supposed to happen. Then you pray to God to change that decree. So it seems to be a non-acceptance. The prayer itself seems right. Itself to be a non-acceptance right. Of God's reality. Very good. That's good. There are 2 points that we have to make first to answer this question. The first point is that we have to make is that we have the right to better our lives and to have a good life as best we can. And therefore, we work and, we make plans, you know, to really try to help ourselves. Like we see by Jacob, even, you know, they really wanted to have a good life, and we have the right to have a good life, okay? One way of having a good life is working within the laws of nature, making plans how to have the best life, okay? The second way how to do it is via God, okay? That's one point, okay, good. But we do have the right to have a good life and do anything we can to have it. Now the question is how does prayer work, okay? Now, most people think that prayer works basically like a child asks a parent. In other words, and even though there is absolutely no change in me and that I don't do anything for you, I keep begging my parents until my parents will give in. That's basically it. Okay? That is not the way prayer works. Prayer is a means of getting close to God. It's like this. There are certain ideas of God that we see to be true, but it runs against our emotions. Emotionally, sometimes it's very difficult to accept. So what we do is that as we pray to God, see, if I know these ideas, then I keep going over these ideas so that my emotions should come in line with it, that I should actually accept these ideas. Now, it could be that the reason why I don't have everything in life is so that I should repent, turn to God through prayer and get closer to God via prayer. That is the purpose why I don't have it. Now, since that is the purpose that I don't have it, once I reach that level, then there's no reason why I shouldn't have it. Then God will give it to me. So prayer really, when we say prayer, prayer is also part of repentance. It's a part of repentance. And so therefore, when I repent and when I come higher and closer to God and my emotions come in line with God, then there's no reason for God to hold back on what he did not give me. So therefore, prayer is not just a request, please overlook my wrongdoings. If I don't have something, it's very possible the reason why I don't have it is because I did something that I'm not living correctly. And therefore, when I find out what I'm doing incorrectly and I straighten that out with the help of prayer, see, the purpose of prayer is to help you reach a higher level, then God doesn't, like, for instance, Joseph. By Joseph, we know that he had a type of ego problem, and he was put in jail for 10 years. Then at the end of 10 years, he showed that he still had a problem, so God kept him in for another 2 years. As soon as the problem was over, God took him right out. There was no reason for him to stay in prison anymore. You see? So the thing is that's the way prayer works, that it helps you reach a higher level. Then once you're at the higher level, then there's no reason for God to hold back on you. Question is that sometimes there's a statement that people say that everything what God does is for the best, okay?
Everything that happens to me.
Everything that happens to me is for the best, okay? Right. Okay. Okay. Good. Everything that happens to me for the best, okay? Okay. Okay. And that's the philosophy of certain people, okay?
Yes.
Now the truth is, if you look at the story of Job. Job had this exact philosophy, you see, and you see that he broke down, okay? Now, that God does everything for the best on this level, in other words, where you don't understand what it means, but you just accept that philosophy, it's a good philosophy. But however, the thing is that psychologically it's impossible to stand up with it. In other words, it might be a good philosophy, but practically it doesn't work. You see, because the human being, when he comes into a catastrophic situation, it's going to break him down. The story of Job, you see, is only one story. There are many, many Jobs. I mean, the book is made to show you how to pull out of it. Not everybody pulls out, but there are a lot of people that start out with that philosophy. If they have a good life their whole life, then fine, then they can live with that philosophy. But as soon as catastrophe comes, it does not work. You see? That was Job. Then there was another person called Rabbi Akiva, who was tortured to death, and he accepted it. You see? You have to understand the difference between Job and Rabbi Akiva, why Job didn't make it. The answer is that Job, throughout the book of Job, is a discussion on a philosophical level of how God relates to the human, you see, and what is God's justice, you see, and how does God's justice work. Once you understand that reality, and then you see that reality, Then you can accept whatever God does is for the best. In other words, like this. One is that I accept God does for the best is like based on ignorance. You see? That psychologically won't help. But once you see that this is reality, there's no doubt because you studied every step and you see that this is reality, it must be this way, then you can stand up to that type of torture. That was Rabbi Akiva. He saw God's system, and he saw that this is, even though it wasn't working good for him, but he related to the whole system, to God's system, and he accepted God's reality. But accepting God's reality could only come after you study God's reality. But if you accept God out of ignorance, psychologically, it's not going to work. Let's say a person who's not perfected yet, and he works out certain decisions on a correct level, and he has a good plan, and he gets a good result. But then in another situation, his emotion comes in, and he makes a terrible error, and he gets the consequences for that error. should that person say Gamzu L'Tova? And how should he, by Gamzu L'Tova mean, is that for the that is all for the best? Okay? The question is, how should he view that insofar as God's will is concerned? Is that for the best?
See, that a wicked person fails, and if you're able to, through the study of Torah, especially in Proverbs, where it shows where the purpose of Proverbs is to show you how to, you know, when you do an act now, what the consequences are, think it out. And you see that a person does an incorrect act. And then you see, and you understand exactly the nature of that act, and you know what the consequences should be. Not like a prophet that you know the exact moment, but you know in general. And then you see as a result of his doing these things, he gets that consequence, you see. So then there's one thing that you do see. You see that God's system really works. You see? The big problem that we have, which is part of the book of Job, is sometimes you see a wicked person that's successful. That is the problem. But however, insofar as I am not perfected, if I'm able to look at myself objectively, and I see that I made, and I look back and I know I made an incorrect decision, and then I get the consequences for that decision, so then I say, yeah, it really works. So in that way I'm saying, yeah, God's system works. That's what we mean by this is also for the best. Because I see that God's system works. That really, according to God's system, in most cases it should be that the righteous should be successful and the wicked should fail. The problem is in the cases where they don't. That's the big question. That we won't discuss. But the thing is that I'm trying to show you in your question how to view it, is that you must, where you fail, and if you could trace it back to the incorrect decision, then you can see that God's systems work. So you should be happy that if you know that if you live according to God's system, you'll be successful, or you'll be able to protect yourself. That's a test that the system really works. The question is, let's say, for instance, you have a wicked person that makes a plan, and you see the wicked person is successful, and he made a plan, so there's no mar. In other words, insofar as planning is concerned, there doesn't seem to be any morality that's attached to it, any morals or ethics that's attached to it. The question, who has the better plan, which doesn't seem to have to do with any morals and ethics, because the wicked could be successful with his plan. Is a metaphor that I've given before in this situation, so I'll just repeat it. Let's say, for instance, there's a child that wants to build a model airplane, and he goes to, and his parents aren't home, and he gets all his equipment, and he builds it on his parents' $20,000 dining room table, okay? Now, of course, when he's using the knife and cutting the model, he makes a few nicks in the table. And, of course, when he starts using the glue, some of the glue gets in there. And then when he starts painting the model, some of the paint gets on there. Now, this child is very, very happy about his success. In fact, he calls all his friends to come over to see his beautiful model that he made. Right? Okay. But that success will last as long as his parents don't come home. Okay? That is the plan of the wicked. Because the plan of the wicked is only in a, only in the immediate area. They don't look at the overall picture. Because their emotions want them to see their success and they keep it in that framework. And if you saw how righteousness and justice and how all these things can help you on the long run, then it would be impossible for you to do evil. Evil is really simple, according to Sadhya Gaon, is ignorance. He's ignorant of what's happening because his emotions don't allow him to see the overall picture. You can only see the overall picture only via justice and righteousness. Okay, the question is, when we see by the people in Torah, like for instance by Joseph, that God put him in jail, and especially to deal with the ego problem, okay? Now, the question is, what about by us where we're not on that level? Is the question is, does God put us into difficult situations to help us cure our problems? The answer is, if you look around life in general, you see that you have many conflicts. You make many mistakes. Bad things happen. That is enough. You don't need God to put you in a worse situation. It's enough just living in the everyday life so that your conflicts are awakened to make you realize that you have to start repenting. By repenting, I mean do a search into the soul to start undoing these problems and the areas, especially in the areas where you make mistakes. That is the area that you should start searching, in the area that you make mistakes. Now, the thing is that, see, the problem is when you reach the level of Joseph, you've undone all areas of mistake except the central personality. Okay? Now, that area might not come up in the physical world. So since you don't run into it naturally in the physical world, so you'll never realize that you have that problem, because you don't see the conflict, you don't see the problems. So what God does is he has to put the tzaddik, who only has that one area, that last area that he has to deal with, to make sure he has to put him in that situation, so the emotion should come forth and how upset he is. Now, sages say that by Jacob, that when Joseph was separated from him, that God did not relate to him for 22 years because he was depressed, and God does not relate for 22 years. That means for 22 years, Jacob lost out on prophecy and the learning that comes through prophecy, the knowledge that comes through prophecy. But all this was worth it because, insofar as God is concerned, this is worth it because it's the perfection of the soul, where you undo any emotion which is contrary to reality. So therefore, once you're put in that situation, it's a conflict. Now, once you have a conflict, then you have to deal with it. These people knew the knowledge of how to deal with their conflicts, because they undid all the others. So therefore, it was only the last one that he had to put them in that situation. But however, God doesn't have to put us in that situation, because just living in this world, we're in that situation, which we already have to deal with. When I'm in a given situation, was I put in that situation, or did God put me in that situation? Okay. Now, the thing is, you have to understand that when you come into this world, you're already in a certain given situation. You didn't choose the situation that you're coming into. Okay? And you don't make many choices till you're around, I would say, 14, 15, or 16, you know what I mean? Where the mind starts thinking and you can start making choices. Basically, you didn't have much choice. So the thing is that the truth is, whether God put you in it or you were there by yourself, you know what I mean, that came by the laws of nature, your job is to start training the mind to see correctly how to deal with any situation. The first situation that you must deal with is the situation you're in. Whatever situation you're in, the odds are there are certain conflicts that you have with it. And there's certain mistakes that you make when you make decisions. So then as you start studying Torah, you start recognizing these errors and you start correcting them. You see? Then after a while, there are new situations which might awaken new emotions and new errors that you didn't know you had. So then you have to work on that. When you've come down to the last one and the odds are that you're not going to even be in such a situation, that's the one that God has to put you in. But your job, whether you're on the level of Joseph where God put him in a situation, or you're on our level where everyday life is a situation where we have to make decisions, we have to make correct decisions. We have to make correct decisions whatever situation we happen to be in. And that's where the training of Torah comes. How to make decisions. How to make decisions, a plan insofar as the laws of nature is concerned, and then how to relate to God insofar as asking God for help. Those are the two ways of dealing with any given situation, any problem. That's the two ways. And therefore, you first must learn those two ways, and then you must learn the emotions that don't let us carry out those two ways, so then we have to deal with those emotions. Results are not in our hands. In our hands is the planning,
to get to the result. Then we have to pray to God, since there's so many factors out of our hands and the laws of nature that we have no control over those areas, then we have to pray to God. But we have to do everything within our ability.
We want
a person that's sick, I mean, from a young age on. The answer is that it's true he doesn't have the same possibilities as a healthy person, but again, he must relate to God in his situation the best that he can. Given his situation, he must operate the best that he can insofar as reality is concerned and insofar as his relationship to God is concerned. He has to do it the best in his situation. Anybody in their situation, okay, must work it out with these two ideas in mind. Insofar as the physical, what could he do to the best that he can? And two, turn to God, that God should help him.
They
could bring out the results that he wants.
What?
Or even to change the results. I mean, God could change results too. I mean, it's possible. So the thing is there, that's where he turns to God.
So we'd like to discuss this evening is what we can do to bring the Messiah. So, chapter 6, verse 2, the portion of Vayera. And it says, God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am God, using the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. And he says, I revealed myself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, which is a different name. And says, I did not make myself known to them by my name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Okay? Now, the pronoun to them usually, in most commentaries, refer to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But, however, there's the Ralbag who says, to them, meaning to the nation of Israel. I did not reveal my name to them, meaning the nation of Israel. They didn't know my name, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Then he goes back to speaking about Abraham, about the forefathers. He says, I also made my covenant with them, promising to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, where they lived as foreigners. Okay? So therefore, he promised that to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that their descendants would own the land. Then he says, I have also heard the groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Okay? Then he says, therefore say to the Israelites in my name, I am God. As I am God, that's Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Exactly what he said, that I did not make known to Israel. I want you to make known to them. Now I want you to teach them the idea of the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. Question is, the Ralbag explains, let's put it this way, the Ralbag explains what's going on here. Let me just tell you, go over the same verses, just showing you how the Ralbag interprets it. He says that the fact that you have not disintegrated, that you're not lost in slavery, with your slave mentality totally gone, the reason why you have not been lost is only because of God's covenant that he promised to the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But however, since you do not know God's name, I can't take you out of Egypt. And I definitely can't give you the Torah, and I definitely can't take you into the land of Canaan. That's something you have to do for yourself. I could keep you alive, you see, and you won't die, but I can't take you out until you know God's name. Okay? That is the way the Ralbag learns the verse here. Okay? Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, it means a certain type of knowledge of God. Okay? And until you have that knowledge of God, God cannot relate to you. Okay? Even though he promised the forefathers, but that is not enough to bring you to Mount Sinai, and not enough to give you the land of Canaan. Okay? That is what the Ralbag says. Judges, in the early prophets, verse 6, it talks about how the children of Israel, sinned. They did evil in the sight of God, and they were given over to the nation of Midian. And it tells their problems and what they had to do and how they operated while they were under the yoke of Midian. In verse 6, it says like this: "And Israel was greatly impoverished because of Midian. And the children of Israel cried to the Lord." Okay? That's verse 6. And then in verse 7 says, "And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried to the Lord because of Midian, that the Lord sent the prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you out of the house of slaves, and I delivered you out of the hand of Egypt, and out of the hand of all those that oppressed you, and drove them out before you, and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorite, in whose land you dwell. But you did not obey my voice." Okay? And that's the end of that. And then the next part, the next verse, that's verse 11. "And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under a terebinth." In other words, an angel of the Lord came and he appoints Gideon to save the nation of Israel. Okay? Gideon. Yeah. And that's the... okay? Now, it's like, why does it... It seems to be going in a certain format here. Okay? We have to understand this format. Okay, what's going on here? Alright? Now, the thing is that... The first thing is that they cry out to God. It's true, the cause, it says it in the verse openly. It says, and Israel was greatly impoverished because of Midian. The children of Israel cried to the Lord, right? And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried to the Lord because of Midian, you see? In other words, it was because of their suffering that they cried to the Lord, right? But however, they did cry to the Lord. Then what happens, God sends a prophet to teach him, to educate him about how God operates. And then it goes on and tells him about exactly what God does, how God took him out of Egypt and why they're being punished. And he gives them an education. Now, it's first after the education about how God relates to Israel that God sends an angel to Gideon to save them. So the order is that there is a cry unto God, you see, and after they cry unto God, then God sends teachers to educate them, and after they're educated, then God frees them. And if you see over here in the Chumash exactly what we're talking about, it says the same thing. Okay, the fact that Israel can't be disintegrated is because of the forefathers. But he says that my name of Yudke Vavke, which means a certain knowledge of how God relates to us, they don't have. So he sends Moshe to educate him. And that was after, and he also says, I have also heard the groaning of Israelites, and the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. You see? So the thing is that there's a certain order for God to give deliverance to Israel. When we're under pressure, when we're being oppressed, we must turn to God. But we don't have all the knowledge. It's just like turning to God in general, in a vague way, you see? So then the only way we can know how God operates is only through education. So God sends people to educate us, you see? And then once he educates us and we have the knowledge of God, only then can God deliver us from whatever oppression we're under at the time. On the story of Samson, okay? Now it says over there that we were enslaved by the Philistines for 40 years. And then later it says that Samson came over and he did his thing. And then at the end of chapter 15, the last verse, it's verse 20, it says, it's talking about Samson. It says, and he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines for 20 years. Okay? Now, during those 20 years, you have to understand what Samson's mission was. Samson's mission was basically to be an outlaw and not to be related to Israel at all. That's why he married the foreign women, so that he shouldn't be related to the Jews, and it's just a fight between him and the Philistines because they did bad to him because of his wife. So he was just taking vengeance, and he was an outlaw. Now, because the Philistines spent 20 years chasing after Samson, so the Jews during that time had a little bit easier than if they weren't busy chasing Samson. That was Samson's mission, to alleviate the bondage, okay, over Israel. And so, therefore, it was for 20 years that he alleviated the bondage, okay? Now, the thing is that that two commentaries, both the Radak and the Rabag, I think it is, they both say that during this 20 years it was alleviated. They both say that the bondage was alleviated for the 20 years that Samson ruled. Okay, now the question is why did Israel have? Why did God give them this respite, this break? You see, the question is right. Now, the thing is, again, the Ralbag, in this week's portion in the Va'era, which we were reading before in the Chumash, the Ralbag says that when God does for it, whatever he does, when he gets involved, it's for the benefit of the soul. The benefit to perfect the person, to bring them closer to God. Okay? So therefore, when sometimes we deserve a break, but we don't deserve total freedom, we don't deserve the total freedom to be free, to be in our own land and to govern ourselves, but just a break, that break really, according to what we said before, is for the purpose of being, since we have a break, we're able to learn, we're able to study. You see, the Jews in Egypt, they were so down in bondage. So it says that they couldn't listen to Moses because they just didn't, they couldn't. They're working like, 20 hours a day. How could you listen to an idea? You see? That's why at a certain point of the plagues, suddenly Israel was not in bondage anymore. And that was the time when their education started. You see? There is a break the Jew is, when he's put into bondage and being oppressed, it's to break him of his attachment to the physical world. You see? Now, once he breaks his attachment, then he could turn to God. You see? Once he could turn to God, that's not enough for him to be freed, but it is enough for God to give him freedom to be able to study. So he sends him to teachers, and he gives them the break to be able to study. Then when he studies, you see, then he, then if he has the knowledge of God, and he has enough knowledge, when he reaches a level when he has enough knowledge, then God could free him from his bondage and take him out. Sign the Balfour Declaration about Israel. The leader, the spiritual leader at the time was the Chafetz Chaim. And he didn't show that much excitement about, the Balfour Declaration, right? That we have the land of Palestine, that we have someplace. And they asked them, they said, aren't you excited? This is the time of the Messiah, you see? So he said, this is not the first time that was the time of the Messiah. There could have been hundreds of times that was the time of the Messiah. But because they didn't take advantage of the situation when they could have studied and they could have repented of their sins, when they had that freedom, they didn't take advantage. They went back to their old ways, so they lost it. In other words, the Messiah could have come. You see? So there you see that the Chafetz Chaim is saying the exact formula, what we're saying. In other words, when we cry to God, that means we really recognize, we've pulled out of our desires and we recognize there is a God. But we don't have the knowledge, so God gives us a respite. He gives us a break. You see? Now the question is, are we going to take advantage of that break to get involved in learning and knowledge and to repent our sins? Or now that we have a break, are we going to get involved in satisfying our own desires? You see? So therefore he says there were many times that there could have been a time for the Messiah. But however, because we didn't take advantage of it, but because there was a break, we went back to our desires, whatever our desires were at the time. You see, whatever we were drawn to at the time, so therefore we lost the chance for the Messiah and went right back into bondage. That is why what a person needs to bring on the Messiah is a knowledge where the nation of Israel gains a knowledge of God. Knowledge of God. When they have that knowledge, then they can, then the Messiah could come. That's a salvation. The Messiah is not a new idea. The Messiah is just the culmination. It's just going to be the culmination, the final step. But however, the thing is that this has been always with Israel, that when we were related to God and related directly to God, so then God gave us the good. And when we turned away and started using the good for our own selfish ends, for our own personal desires, and we turned away from God, so then, let's put it this way. When we use the physical world as a means towards relating to God, then we were successful. But as soon as we took the physical world and it ended in of itself and to enjoy the physical world per se, that is when we lost it. It seems that they were taught on Mount Sinai, which is after they got out, right? But he didn't teach them before they got out, okay? You have to understand that Mount Sinai was given our halachic system, okay? What we're talking about here is knowledge of God, okay? Now, how God relates to us, that's what it says, that was Moshe's first act to teach him about God. He went there first to speak to them, but however, because of their broken, then they, you know, like they couldn't even think, so he failed, you see? And then only later, when they had a certain amount of freedom, did he start educating them. Now you have to understand also that the 10 plagues is also knowledge of how God relates. That in itself, the 10 plagues. The plagues was 1 week of plague, and 3 weeks, nothing. That means each plague could be analyzed over the month by the Jews. You see, and educated on how God relates to his enemies, how God relates to his people, and the knowledge of God, and how God, whatever knowledge they needed, you see, that was given to them over these 10 months. In fact, the Ralbag does mention the unbelievable swiftness in which they gained that knowledge. He says that's unbelievable that in only 10 months they gained the knowledge of God enough to be taken to Mount Sinai. He says that you cannot believe how unbelievable that is. You see? So the thing is that it could take you years. In other words, that's why by Samson they had a 20-year break. Now, if they used it for good, then they would have been freed. If not, then they would have gone back into bondage. But it takes time to gain the knowledge of God, and you're talking about a nation as a whole. Well, most of the nation, I don't know the quantity which is necessary. So the thing is that it takes time. But it's a certain type of knowledge, and yes, they were educated during the time during the time of the happening of the 10 plagues, they were being educated. We'd just like to interpret two verses in Kings 2. It's Kings 2, chapter 5, and it's the story of Naaman, who had the leprosy, and he was told about the prophet Elisha, that Elisha could cure him of his leprosy. And he goes to Israel, and he comes to the door of the, he comes to the house of Elisha, and Elisha sends a messenger to him. He doesn't meet with him. He says, go to the River Jordan and dip yourself 7 times and you'll be cured. Okay? 11, it says, right after that it says, but Naaman was angry and went away and said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and so heal the infected person. Then he says in verse 12, are not Amana and Papa rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in rage. Now the question is, what's bothering Naaman? I mean, maybe in Damascus they have one type of mumbo jumbo, maybe in Israel we have a different type of mumbo jumbo. You know what I mean? What is bothering him, and why does he say? I mean, the prophet says that you should go to the River of Jordan. He says, well, I could clean myself in the rivers of Damascus. I mean, what is he saying here? What's bothering Naaman? What's bothering him? The answer is that he had a certain view of religion, okay? And basically, there was a dichotomy between his secular life and his religious life. And you find it a lot today also. There is, let's say, for instance, I go to a doctor and I have a skin disease. So I'll say, wash it with a disinfectant to make sure it doesn't spread and do this, you know? But if I go to a prophet and I go to a doctor, I mean to a religious man to perform a miracle on me, you see, or if I go to the witch doctor, then I expect something else. I expect him to do his mumbo jumbo and remove all the things. See, that's what he's saying. He's saying there's two separate things. There's my relationship with the religious world, and that I want miracles and cures and do your thing, you know, and then it should go away. Then there's the world of medicine, the world of the secular world. Well, there they'll tell me to make sure to keep it clean and to make sure I wash and bathe and all these things. What he didn't understand is that God never performs a miracle unless you do everything that you can in the physical world. You see? Now, the thing is that in all the miracles, practically every miracle that I've read about, I haven't read about all of them, but from all the miracles that I've read, there is always an act, something that has to do with the miracle. You must do something in the physical. You must do some act, physical act. And that idea shows that a God relating to us is only after we have done everything in our, it's like a continuation into the next step. The next step, when you go this far and it doesn't work, then we try the next step. You see? But the thing is that you must go all the way in the secular world. When we look at the secular world, we say, well, didn't God create that too? That's God's world too. So when we live in a secular world, we're really living in God's world. But in other religions, the way they look at it, there's two separate worlds. You see? Like, for instance, a fundamentalist will not use certain medicine. They totally rely on God. 1 minute, isn't that medicine created by God? It might have been discovered by man, but it was only discovered by man only after he studied God's world. In other words, within God's world is those properties that you could bring it out. You see? So the thing is that it's only after the human being does everything that is necessary in the physical, what he can do practically, it is only then that God will take the next step and he will affect the physical world. See, that was Naaman's problem. He didn't understand that how Elisha worked. You see, and he's sort of going washing. What a matter! I just came from the Mesa. Probably the capital was a powerful country. I mean, they have all the things. What's the matter with their rivers? What's the matter with their doctors? You see? Well, what is he telling me to wash? Let him do his mumbo jumbo. You see? He didn't understand. No. You have to wash. You have to do everything that is possible in the laws of nature. Then and only then could you take the next step. This is the prophecy. What is prophecy and how it works? What happens is that it's really in the same sense that we discussed by Naaman. And that is, a person has to sit down and study the world, what the world is. That way he gets to know God through God's creation. With the help of Torah, the Torah guides us to see clearly how to look at the world so that we shouldn't miss up things. You see? Now, at a certain point, when you have done everything that you can in the physical world, you see, and you could, everything that you can see, that you have the ability to see, you have made your ability active, totally active. There's nothing left in the ability stage, and you cannot move ahead along the lines of the laws of nature. Then at a certain point, then God opens the world for you. How it works, I don't know. I don't know what happens exactly. But the thing is, at a certain point, prophecy is where your mind is open. The prophecy that we read about, that's public prophecy, where the purpose of the prophet is to do justice to the nation and to teach them and to educate them and to try to help them in whatever way possible. But the prophecy that we're talking about is a continuation of your knowledge. After you've done everything that is possible, then God helps you in some way in seeing the... But it's you still working on it, and you still developing. Okay. We're talking about starting from Kings 2, chapter 4. And it's the story of the woman that builds a room for Elisha the prophet, so that whenever he comes by, he should be comfortable and have a place to stay. It's chapter 4, but it starts with the verse 8. It starts with verse 8. Okay? That's where the story starts from. And, it was after she built that chamber. In verse 12, he calls the Shunammite woman, and she stood before him, and he said to him, him meaning he said to his person that took care of, that stayed with him, like his manservant, say now to her, behold, you have been careful to make her to have all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? And then he asked her, it seems like she didn't have any problems, and so he started suggesting, maybe I could speak to the king for you, maybe I could speak to the general. And she answers, I dwell among my own people, in other words, I have security, and I have all the security I need, I don't need anything else. Then after she left, he says to his manservant, he says, what then is to be done for her? Well, the question is, why does he continue with this involvement? He did everything he can to do something for her. There was nothing to do. He should quit, but no, that's not enough. And then Gehazi answered, that was the name of the manservant, that she has no child, and her husband is old. And he said, call her, and when he had called her, she stood in the door, and he said, about this time in the coming year you shall embrace a son. In other words, I mean, first I can try to do everything within the laws of nature for you. And then if not, then I insist on doing a miracle for you. What's this urgency in doing something for her? You see? Okay? The answer is like this. The answer is that the subject that we're talking about is appreciation. Most people understand appreciation is that I have a certain feeling towards you. And sometimes a thank you, if a situation comes, I could help you, since you were nice to me, I'll be nice to you. That's not so in the mind of Elisha, and that's not so in the eyes of Torah. Appreciation is a debt. It's a debt. I owe you, you see. Now the thing is that there are two types of debts. There's a debt that if you don't pay me, I'll take you to court. There's a debt that I can't take you to court, but you have to recognize that you owe, and that you have a real obligation to pay. You see? Now, if that is true, that there is a debt, how do you evaluate what you owe? Right? The question is, how do you evaluate? The way you evaluate what you owe is you have to see what the other person did for you. In other words, let's say, for instance, I buy something and it saves my life. I don't owe the salesman my life. I only owe him for paying what he did. Unless a person goes out of his way to save my life, then I owe him my life. But the thing is that whatever a person does, I have to analyze exactly what the person did, and that becomes my debt. Okay? In the case of Elisha, he felt that he couldn't pay her within the laws of nature. He has the ability for miracles, so he paid her that way. Okay? Paid her. That's the way he paid his debt. But the thing is that many times you notice that when we speak about God, we go in detail of what God did for us. You see? Why do I have to know exactly every step what God did? Why can't I just look at the results? The answer is because I also owe God a debt for what he did. That's a real debt. The only difference between God and the human, God I can't pay back. But I must recognize, if it's somebody I cannot pay back, then I must recognize, at least recognize that debt. You see? That is why our sages could say there are three partners in the making of a human, right? God, father, and mother. Now, how could our sages equate God with two human beings? Parents. How could he equate? The answer is, insofar as my debt of my existence, I owe all three. That's my debt. So I owe my parents the same debt that I owe God. For my parents, I can't pay back. You can't pay back for existence. How can you pay back for being existence? So we have certain laws of honoring father and mother. But the same thing with God. With God, I can't pay back at all, but I must recognize what he did for me. You see? So the thing is that we have to understand when somebody does something for you, that it is a debt. And then an obligation and a responsibility to have in mind that you must pay back. Okay.